Welcome to our podcast. I'm Frank Long, Editorial Director of Rehab Management. And joining me for this podcast is compliance expert Nancy Beckley, President of Nancy Beckley & Associates Rehab Compliance Resources. Nancy, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Frank. This is Rehab Management's longest-running podcast. It is so much fun to be here. There's a continued interest in compliance out there, and I know that you always ask me, what is it about compliance that makes it kind of unique? Well, let's say more therapists now than ever have had their charts reviewed as a result of manual medical review of Medicare therapy claims over $3,700 by the RAC, the recovery auditors. Providers have been subject to claims rejection from audits by Medicare contractors such as Safeguard Services on two different therapy audits that were assigned by CMS, and there has been continued news generated by both the Office of the Inspector General and the Department of Justice reports of legitimate therapy providers, as well as the therapy sham operators, that are caught up in the Medicare strike force dragnet. And a lot of folks are simply using the word compliance to kind of mean everything. For example, an EMR program may promote that you will meet Medicare compliance requirements if you simply use their EMR program. While not entirely false, it's not entirely true. And if you're using an EMR program, one thing it's not going to do is write your notes for you. It won't check your credentialing. It won't conduct compliance investigations. It won't run your compliance hotline or your communication system. And it won't dole out disciplinary procedures as a result of noncompliance. But then again, Frank, with the rapid advances in technology, who knows, there will never be a shortage of hot topics in compliance.
Speaking of hot topics, Nancy, you always begin your podcast with hot topics. So what are the hot compliance topics for therapy providers this year?
Well, first of all, HIPAA's pretty hot because in 2013, we actually had the final compliance date for what's called the omnibus rule. So that's still kind of hot because there's a lot of providers out there that haven't realized that they not only need to update their privacy and security risk assessments, but also their updated notices of privacy practices. But from my perspective, relying on information that is inaccurate when making decisions on compliance matters such as documentation, coding, and credentialing or other statutory requirements is also a hot topic. The fact that the Office of the Inspector General is continuing to audit therapy practices under their 2013 and 2014 work plans, it's since then we've received a report regarding an Illinois private practice provider just this August that had a 99% error rate reported by the Office of the Inspector General. So that's pretty hot. And then there's that whole issue of cash therapy practices and compliance, which is trending right now.
Nancy, I'm curious about the cash and compliance topic. Can you tell me what is the compliance hook with that?
Sure, Frank. Well, you know, as reimbursement is shrinking and the regulatory environment is heating up with audits, as well as mandatory coding and reporting for functional limitation reporting and the multiple procedure payment reductions that Medicare is doing and everybody deciding that they want to be a mini Medicare Me Too and any compliance thing that Medicare puts into place that's actually going to beat you down on reimbursement or cause you to do more paperwork, the other insurance plans are interested in copying them. So there's really a huge interest by a lot of folks out there, not just private practices, but hospital practices and skilled that have outpatient components. Everybody wants to find out how they can get a little cash into their practice. So you have existing practices that are adding elements of cash only, as well as solo and small group practitioners who are entering the market from the very, very beginning with only accepting cash. So they have an entrepreneurial spirit and want to start their therapy practice by only accepting cash. The pure model, of course, is pay for service at the time of service. Like when you go into the grocery store and you buy your groceries, you go out through the checkout and you pay for your groceries. You know, whether it's a credit card or a check or actually cash, that's cash. It's the same concept with a therapy practice. So the practice is going to save the overhead of back office services of things like insurance verification, billing, rebilling, and did I mention rebilling, and reauthorizations as well as refunds. And then on top of that, Medicare audits, insurance audits, and just a lot of additional paperwork just to treat a patient for the purchase of their own health insurance. So it's very frustrating all the way around. There's also a lot of hybrid models out there in any specific market that include out-of-network insurance billing. So a practice might not enroll with health plans but agree to bill a health plan on an out-of-network basis as a courtesy to the patient. The first compliance hook, Frank, as you put it, is understanding that HIPAA regulations, yep, HIPAA right here in cash practice, that HIPAA regulations from a covered entity perspective, as well as updated HIPAA rules from the Omnibus Act, which I mentioned earlier in 2013, they allow a patient to restrict disclosure to health plans for the purposes of billing and payment, wherein the patient has paid cash for the services, so they are allowed to ask their insurance company not to be billed for those services. There's another compliance hook in the continued fascination with the Medicare population in cash therapy. So while a motivation in becoming a cash therapy practice is certainly to get away from the regulations in the traditional therapy market, there's that fascination with having access to all the upcoming baby boomers in the Medicare population. However, Medicare regulations require that all therapy services that are medically necessary be billed to Medicare. So if a practice is not enrolled in Medicare, doesn't understand the Medicare regulations, doesn't really know what the Medicare skilled and medically necessary requirements mean, doesn't understand the Medicare benefits policy manual, hasn't read the local Medicare coverage determination, it's practically impossible for them to look at a potential patient which is enrolled in Medicare, how to get a piece of that Medicare action, so to speak, that population, for therapy that's not medically necessary. So herein lies the dilemma. Practices that are currently enrolled in Medicare generally treat a patient under Medicare's medical necessity guidelines, and then they taper the treatment and discharge a patient when medical necessity guidelines are no longer met. That's something that all therapy providers that are enrolled in Medicare have certainly been trained to do since the therapy cap came into permanent fixture in 2006, and we've had now the RAC audits and manual medical review over the past several years. Therapy practices really have a good sense of when treatment is no longer medically necessary and begin to taper that treatment. So these practices that are enrolled in Medicare also often arrange for a patient to continue in a therapy program or a modified therapy wellness program on some level of fee basis, whether through a Medicare ABN, where you're notifying the patient that services are no longer medically necessary, but the patient chooses to get traditional physical, occupational, or speech therapy and pay for it, or some general wellness type of a membership program for people that want to continue to come to therapy but may not necessarily need one-on-one physical therapy under the Medicare definition. So now let's flip back at those cash practices that wish to treat Medicare. They may not have the requisite understanding of the Medicare rules of medical necessity. They might not have evaluated the patient and understood when they've reached their maximum Medicare benefit under the medical necessity guidelines. So they may actually be vulnerable to treating a patient for therapy that was medically necessary, and therefore there's an obligation to submit this to Medicare under the law. So there's a lot of hitches in here with Medicare and cash. I actually started a mentoring program with some students from one of the local universities, physical therapy students in Milwaukee, and that is the project that they picked to take a look at, is what are the implications if you're going to open up a cash therapy practice. And there's a lot of folks that are so interested in doing it right now, but there's that unique fascination with how do I get a hold of the Medicare population, which is kind of that little juxtaposition with, if you don't understand the Medicare rules, you may be tiptoeing into an arena that could potentially cause more compliance problems than not.
Here's a question all of our listeners will want to know more about. What should a therapy practice do to get its compliance program in compliance?
Well, Frank, you know from talking to me on the longest standing podcast with Rehab Management that I could probably talk about compliance all day long, and compliance is something I'm really excited about. And the reason I'm excited about this is I've seen things from the dark side of the moon, so to speak. A large part of what I do is work with therapy providers that are currently under audit or under investigation. And so when you see the dire circumstances that somebody may find themselves in because they've been selected randomly for an audit, or perhaps they've had a whistleblower complaint regarding their practice, you see the dire side of compliance from people that didn't have a compliance program in place. So the best start for a compliance program is a risk assessment. While there are general risks inherent in being a therapy provider, as well as for any provider that's enrolled with Medicare, the risks should be specific to your particular therapy program and therapy practice. Once risks are assessed in a compliance plan, you can incorporate the 7 elements of a compliance plan per the Office of the Inspector guidelines, as well as the updated federal sentencing guidelines. You should develop your compliance program and scale it to the size and resources of your practice. In fact, that's allowed under the program guidance for physicians and small practices, which by reference in there includes physical therapy practices. Compliance programs are updated and mandated under the Affordable Care Act. However, the guidelines have not yet been published, even though they were supposed to have been published in 2013. The best practice per the Office of Inspector General is to adapt one of the compliance guidances already published on their website and begin today. That's right, Frank, today. No time should be let gone here to get going under the Affordable Care Act, as the anticipated regulations, when they're published, are very likely to parallel existing Office of Inspector General guidances that have been available for the last 14 to 15 years. While providers often associate documentation and coding with compliance, and therefore chart reviews with compliance, from my perspective, that is only one of several elements. In fact, Rick Gawenda, a good friend of mine, good colleague that's a documentation and coding expert, has asked me to come on board and present a seminar, which I've titled The 7 Deadly Compliance Mistakes and How to Avoid Them. I'll be doing that with him in November and really delving into everything that I've learned from providers that haven't had the luxury of having a compliance program. It's no longer a luxury, but a necessity. One bit of guidance that I can't overstate enough is who and who you rely on for your compliance guidance. The OIG has indicated in formal presentation to the members of the Compliance Institute that it does not take lightly the practice of relying on chat groups, listservs, and other online forums where guidance is passed around willy-nilly that's not necessarily based upon statutory references, but rather what somebody thinks needs to be done. Medicare guidance and contractor policy should really prevail when you're making decisions on how to bill, how to code, how to document, or do anything else for that matter under your compliance program. For any provider under investigation, there's likely going to be a preservation order to include emails and text messages. And if those are reviewed, the OIG and other investigative authorities will know where you sought and where you received your advice.
Nancy, how can providers get in touch with you if they have a compliance question or concern?
Well, if you're going to be up at the APTA Private Practice Section meeting November 6th through 7th, 2014 in Colorado Springs, I'm actually going to be providing a complimentary monitoring and auditing tool, and I'll be available at the clinician booth. I've teamed up with Clinician on a number of complimentary webinars to the industry, and they've asked me if I'd like to offer some complimentary services and offer them from their booth, and of course I said yes. For folks with compliance questions, I use the Clarity service, wherein a consultation can be scheduled to discuss the areas of concerns any practice might have. You can register for that on my website. And payment is per the minute, and I ask that documents be sent to me ahead of time to ensure an efficient call. It's a great way for a non-client to be a client for as many minutes as they need to get compliance under control. That's it, Frank.
I've been speaking today with compliance expert Nancy Beckley of Nancy Beckley & Associates Rehab Compliance Resources. Nancy, thank you for this very valuable information, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Frank. Let's do this again next year and keep the longest-running podcast on rehab management going.